Welcome to Cut and Thrust, your podcast for the bloody and sometimes bizarre journey through the Middle Ages. Whether it's dark battles, questionable hygiene, or hair-raising rulers, here you'll get history as it really was, raw and unfiltered. So grab your sword, put on your helmet, and let's dive into the wild world of the past.
Hello and a warm welcome to a new episode of the Battle Merchant Podcast. My name is Hendrik.
And I'm Carmen. Today we've got a really juicy topic lined up. Myths and misconceptions about medieval battles, weapons and armor.
And there are plenty of those. I mean, we all know the movie scenes. Two armies facing each other, someone bellows a battle cry, and then everyone charges at once and starts bashing each other wildly. Total chaos, all over in 5 minutes.
Although that obviously works great dramatically. For Hollywood, a head-on collision like that is just visually spectacular. But if you look at how medieval battles actually played out, it was almost the complete opposite. They were tactically sophisticated, often lasting for hours.
That's the crucial point. A medieval pitched battle often started out quite static. Both sides took up position. You sized up the enemy. Archers fired a few volleys. Then there were usually advances first, skirmishes, a drawn-out struggle over positions. The escalation to a full-scale attack only came when one side spotted a clear advantage. Though, depending on the era and region, things could escalate more quickly.
The Battle of Hastings in 1066 is a textbook example. Harold Godwinson had positioned his Anglo-Saxons on Senlac Hill, with a dense shield wall. Huskards at the front, the elite with their heavy Danish axes. Behind them, the Fürth militia. The Normans had to attack uphill, and the shield wall held for hours. It dragged on the entire day, from morning until late afternoon.
And William ultimately cracked it. Probably through feint retreats, although that's debated among historians. Parts of the Anglo-Saxon line broke formation to pursue the seemingly fleeing Normans. And then they were isolated and cut down by the cavalry. A disciplined shield wall was highly resilient, but not invincible.
This illustrates an important principle. Defensive positions were an enormous advantage in the Middle Ages. If you had a good position and kept your nerve, you often had the upper hand. You can see the same thing with the Hussites in the 15th century and their wagon forts. The Hussites are a fantastic example of that. Jan Žižka chained war wagons together into mobile fortresses, armed with hook guns and howitzers. At the Battle of Tachov in 1427, the Hussites faced a much larger Crusader army, and the Crusaders fled before any real fighting even started. The sight of the wagon fort, the thunder of the guns. But also leadership disputes among the commanders, the morale after the defeat at Svetl, and the difficult terrain. It all played together.
Which once again underscores how important tactical innovation was. The Hussites fended off 5 crusades with that method. This wasn't mindless brawling, it was a carefully thought-out combination of artillery, infantry, and light cavalry for the counterattack.
That brings us to another point that gets completely lost in movies. Medieval armies weren't just a bunch of people with weapons. They were typically deployed in 3 divisions: vanguard, main force, and reserve. Each division had its own role.
The vanguard often had ranged troops, archers, crossbowmen. The main force with the heavy cavalry and foot soldiers. And the reserve for flanking attacks or when things got dicey somewhere. It was a system that could respond flexibly.
Although tactics varied greatly depending on the region and era, the early Middle Ages looked very different from the late Middle Ages, where infantry formations like the Swiss pike squares became increasingly important. There wasn't one single medieval way of fighting.
And there wasn't just one single reason for going to war either. That's another myth that movies love to play up. Some evil king always marches off to conquer foreign lands. In reality, the most common triggers for wars were, how should I put it, more of a legal dynastic nature. Succession disputes, power claims, feudal conflicts.
The Hundred Years' War is the prime example. At its core, it began because Edward III claimed the French throne through his mother Isabella. The Wars of the Roses in England, Lancaster versus York, also a dynastic conflict over the crown. These weren't simple raids. They had complex political and legal backgrounds.
Pure wars of conquest, the way Hollywood portrays them, were more the exception. And even when there was expansion, like the Ostsiedlung or the Crusades, it was usually legitimized through legal titles, through religious authority. At the same time, expansion, feuds, and border wars were a constant presence. The lines were blurry. People didn't just stand up and say, "I want that, so I'm taking it."
Although the result was sometimes the same anyway. But legitimacy mattered to people. Without a legal basis, you risk being ostracized by other lords.
Which, of course, makes it all the more fascinating. Medieval warfare was a highly complex interplay of diplomacy, tactics, and technology. A far cry from the cinematic cliché of the mindless hack-and-slash mentality.
And those complex backgrounds are exactly what we want to unravel in this episode. There's still a lot to cover about the weapons and armor themselves, where the myths are at least just as persistent. Let's move on to one of my absolute favorite myths, the immobile knight who has to be hoisted onto his horse with a crane and lies there like a turtle on its back after a fall.
Yeah, that image is incredibly persistent, and it's fundamentally wrong. A well-crafted plate armor from the 15th century weighed around 20 to 25 kilos for field use. And the key thing is the weight distribution. The weight didn't sit only on the shoulders like with a mail shirt. Instead, it was spread across the entire body. Chest, back, arms, legs, everything bore a share of the load.
And you notice that immediately when you've actually worn one yourself. A mail shirt weighs around 10 to 12 kilos, and that weight rests mainly on the shoulders and neck, unless you belt it well and have padding underneath, in which case some of the weight shifts to the hips. After an hour, you really feel it. A suit of plate armor at a similar weight feels considerably more comfortable because of the distribution across the hips and legs. You can walk in it, bend over, get back up when you're on the ground. Experienced fighters could run in full armor.
To be fair, we should differentiate. The claim that knights could perform acrobatic maneuvers in it, which you sometimes read, is a bit of an exaggeration. It allowed good mobility, yes, but acrobatics in the modern sense? You have to look closely at that. You could move, fight, mount your horse without help, but you still had 20 kilos on your body. At some point, that does limit you.
For comparison, today's soldiers carrying body armor, a helmet, ammunition, and a backpack often carry a similar weight, sometimes even more. And they move through difficult terrain with all that. That puts the myth into perspective quite significantly.
And we shouldn't forget that plate armor was the endpoint of a long evolution. Armor technology developed gradually over centuries. First, textile armor, like the gambeson. Then mail shirts. Then individual plate pieces at critical areas. And finally, the full plate harness.
The gambeson, by the way, is such an underrated piece of equipment. Depending on the region and period, there were two construction methods. Either multiple layers of linen or wool fabric quilted together, or stuffed with wool, cotton, or fabric scraps. both produced a really thick padding. It weighed an estimated 3 to 6 kilos, and on its own already provided surprisingly good protection against cuts and blunt force. Many common soldiers wore nothing but a gambeson.
And even underneath a mail shirt, the gambeson was essentially mandatory. Without that padding underneath, a mail coat transfers the force of a blow directly to the body. The combination of textile padding and mail was the standard for centuries. A really solid compromise between protection and mobility.
Although, when it comes to the history of armor development, there's one thing that's actually debated among historians. The blog post also mentions leather armor as a stage in the evolution, and that's historically quite contentious.
Standalone leather armor in the European Middle Ages as independent protective equipment, many historians today view that critically. There was hardened leather, cuir bouilli, used for individual components. But as a full-fledged alternative to mail, the gambeson and mail proved to be superior and even cheaper.
That's basically a myth that comes mainly from film and fantasy. You constantly see those brown leather armors on screen because they look good visually. In reality, leather was more commonly used as a carrier material for metal pieces or for individual components. With brigandines, for example, those had metal plates riveted between layers of leather or fabric, but that wasn't a pure leather armor.
That inevitably raises the question of why the myth of the immobile knight persists so stubbornly. There's a fairly obvious explanation that's often overlooked. It's the confusion between field armor and tournament armor.
The jousting harness.
Tournament armor, especially the jousting harness designed for lance combat, was indeed significantly heavier than field armor. It had massive reinforcements on the chest against lance impacts. Specialized helmets like the frogmouth helm, which looked practically welded shut, these could weigh over 40 kilos. You really could barely move in them. But you didn't need to. You were sitting on the horse and riding in a straight line.
That's probably the source of the myth. When people see the ornate, massive tournament armor in museums, they think, that's how they fought in war too. But field armor was a completely different product. Lighter, more flexible, designed for versatility.
By the way, if you're enjoying this episode, feel free to subscribe or recommend us to others. That helps us cover even more topics like this.
And armor development didn't progress at the same pace everywhere. Northern Italy, especially Milan, was a center of the armorer's craft. They were far ahead technologically. In other regions of Europe, people were still fighting primarily in mail shirts at the same time. There was no universal update for everyone at once.
Which makes the whole thing even more fascinating. Medieval armor technology was genuine engineering, custom-made, optimized for the wearer. A gradual process spanning centuries. A far cry from the clunky tin can that movies love to sell us. Let's move on to the weapons themselves, because there's one myth that runs particularly deep. In practically every medieval movie, the sword is the weapon of choice. The hero draws his sword, and that's what he fights with.
And in reality, the sword was a sidearm for most fighters. On the battlefield, pole arms had absolute priority. Spears, lances, halberds, anything that offers reach. The reason is simple. If you can hit your opponent from 3 or 4 meters away, you have a massive advantage over someone who has to close to arm's length first.
You can basically compare the sword to a pistol for modern soldiers. They also carry an assault rifle as their primary weapon and the pistol as backup, in case things get tight. In the same way, the sword was the weapon for when the lance was broken or the fighting got so close that you couldn't handle a pole arm anymore.
And now, a quick word from our sponsor. Feeling curious? Then head over to battlemerchant.com. They've got all sorts of medieval stuff, from costumes to armor and loads more. Totally worth a look.
We shouldn't forget, though, why movies always put the sword center stage. That has less to do with military reality than with symbolism. A sword was a status symbol. Knights were girded with the sword. Oaths were sworn on swords. It was the symbol of the knightly class. That's what makes it so attractive on film.
And in a duel, it obviously looks better than a lance. Two knights with 5-meter-long spears trying to keep each other at a distance, that's dramatically just less spectacular, let's put it that way. But militarily, that was the reality.
That applies to maces and warhammers too, by the way. They're often portrayed as the ultimate armor crushers. As if to say, what the sword can't cut through, the mace simply smashes. In reality, the way they worked was different. They were meant to transfer the impact force to the wearer, not to break through the armor. A decent suit of plate armor would absorb a hit, but a powerful blow could still break bones or put the opponent out of action.
What almost never appears in movies are knife-like weapons. Falchions, for example. Or the so-called langes Messer, the long knife. These were enormously widespread in the late Middle Ages, especially among the foot troops and infantry, among fighters below the knightly class.
A falchion was basically a single-edged cutting weapon with a broad blade, lighter than a knightly sword, and above all, cheaper to produce. The Thorpe falchion from England, dated to around 1320, weighed just under 900 grams. These were practical, everyday weapons for people who couldn't, or didn't want to, afford an expensive sword.
And the langes Messer was the German-speaking word's counterpart. Similar function, but with riveted grip scales instead of a sword hilt. You can find them described in detail in the fight books of Talhofer or Hans Le Küchner. In reenactment, they're actually very popular, because they're versatile and handy.
Which brings us to the longbow. And this is where it gets really interesting. The English longbow was, without a doubt, an effective ranged weapon. But it was no silver bullet that could effortlessly punch through any armor. The bows recovered from the Mary Rose, one of the most important warships of Henry VIII, which sank in 1545, they had draw weights of 120 to 160 pounds. That's 55 to 72 kilos. To draw a bow like that, you needed years of training from childhood. The skeletons of archers show actual deformities in the shoulders and spine from the constant strain.
And despite that enormous power, against a good suit of plate armor, even a bow like that often wasn't enough. You also have to distinguish, in mass volleys at 150 to 200 meters, it wasn't about precision, it was about volume. Thousands of arrows into a formation. You'll always hit someone in a poorly protected spot. But aimed at a single knight in full plate, that was a different matter entirely.
The principle was more like artillery, area effect rather than a single shot. And that's precisely why armor evolved in response. It was a constant arms race that ran through the entire era.
This becomes especially clear with the emergence of firearms in the 14th century. Many people think that was the instant end of knightly armor. Bang, shot, armor useless.
And in reality?
It was exactly the other way around. The first hand cannons around 1330 to 1340 were primitive muzzle loaders with barrels of maybe 20 to 60 centimeters in length. They had a rate of fire of about once per minute if things went well. A longbowman could lose 10 to 12 arrows in the same time. And the penetrating power? Initially, it was in the range of a good crossbow, but heavily dependent on caliber, powder, and distance. Up to about 100 meters, they could pierce knightly armor. Beyond that, their effectiveness dropped off sharply.
So the armorers didn't give up. They adapted. The plate armor of the 15th century was reinforced deliberately, with thicker plates on the chest, angled surfaces to deflect projectiles. Some harnesses even bear proof marks as evidence of quality, where the armorer demonstrated that the piece could withstand a shot.
It took over 200 years from the first hand cannons until firearms were truly powerful enough that armor could no longer keep up. It wasn't a sudden revolution, but a gradual process.
And even then, breastplates persisted well into the 17th century, with the cuirassiers, for example. The arms race between offense and defense is ultimately a common thread that runs through the entire history of warfare, right up to the present day, really. Now, we've talked about battles, armor, and weapons, and busted a whole bunch of myths. But the question remains, why do these misconceptions persist so stubbornly?
Because movies and TV series simply operate by different rules than history books. A tactically managed battle that drags on for hours, with long phases of waiting and maneuvering, that's nearly impossible to tell in an exciting way within 20 minutes of screen time. So things get compressed, simplified, dramatized. Two armies charge at each other. The hero swings his sword. All over in 5 minutes. That's understandable from a storytelling perspective, but historically, it's nonsense.
The problem is that those images stick in your mind. If you've seen 10 times how knights can barely move, or how a sword stroke effortlessly cuts through armor, you start believing it at some point, even if you actually know it wasn't like that. Shows like Vikings do some things better. They at least portray the brutality and chaos more realistically. But even there, things are compressed and adjusted for the sake of drama.
Fortunately, though, a lot has changed in recent years. Productions work more often with historical consultants. There's more awareness of it. Outlaw King, about Robert the Bruce, was a pretty good example. Much more grounded than a Braveheart. But at the end of the day, the conflict between entertainment and accuracy remains.
And that's where reenactment comes in for me. When you've actually stood in a mail shirt yourself, when you try to hold formation while everything around you descends into chaos, you immediately notice what movies get wrong. It's a form of knowledge transfer that no book and no film can replace. You literally grasp why formations were so important, why defensive positions, as we saw at Hastings, are such an advantage.
Exactly. And beyond the hands-on experience, there are of course the sources themselves, archaeological finds, contemporary chronicles, the fight books we mentioned. Our picture of medieval warfare is constantly changing because new discoveries emerge or old sources are reinterpreted. It's a living research process.
That's what I find the fascinating thing about it. Medieval warfare wasn't simple hack and slash. As we saw with the armor, there was genuine engineering behind it. Tactical thinking in the formations, centuries of weapons development. Reducing all of that to a few movie cliches simply doesn't do the era justice.
That's perhaps the most important takeaway from this entire episode. The complexity and diversity of medieval warfare deserves a closer look. Don't believe everything you see at the movies. Question the sources. Stay curious. Historical knowledge keeps evolving, and every new insight makes the picture a little more complex.
And once you start getting into it?
You won't be able to stop anytime soon. I can confirm that from personal experience.
That's true. And with that, we've reached the end of the episode. If this topic grabbed your attention and you want to dive even deeper, on battlemerchant.com in the blog, you'll find a whole range of additional articles on historical topics. And of course, an extensive selection for anyone who doesn't just want to read about history, but experience it firsthand.
Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.
Take care, and stay curious.
And so we ride towards the end of this episode. Keep your sword sharp and your mugs full. We'll catch you in the next one.